This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When some people are raised in small towns, they can have dreams of leaving when they grow up. Well, I don't know if our guest this hour had any dreams about leaving, but when he grew up, he did leave Statesville by leaving the planet. A physician, he became a flight surgeon and then a NASA astronaut who has been given the opportunity to spend time at the International Space Station on several occasions. So few people have had that opportunity. We wanted to spend some time with Dr. Tom Marshburn and find out more about what he has experienced and what those experiences have taught him. And he joins us for the hour from the Houston Space Flight Center. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
I'm great. I should point out to our listeners that there's about a one-second delay, so sometimes it may sound like a pregnant pause. It's just because my voice has not gotten to Dr. Marshburn in time. Being an astronaut is a pretty rare accomplishment in life. Is it something you always wanted to do, or did this direction of your life surprise you?
When I was about 8 or 9 years old, I began to think, boy, sending things into space is incredible. I was in our elementary school library reading about how the government was building satellites and weather satellites, sending them into space. And I thought robotics was an interesting thing. It wasn't until years later that I started to think people actually have been sent into space, and maybe I could be one of those people. So it was lifelong, but gradually increasing.
But you were, we were born in what, 1960?
That's right, 1960.
So
in
when
Statesville.
So when you were 8 or 9, we were in the process of or had put men on the moon. Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong were on the moon. So obviously that did you watch that moon landing? Did you watch the moon walks? They were on pretty late at night on the East Coast. But why did it take so long for it to occur to you that people had gone up there?
Oh yeah, well the. It's the difference between seeing something on television, and it absolutely amazed me. I remember being in a bathroom, sitting on the living room floor in my grandmother's house as the whole family gathered around to watch this grainy black and white image, and a lot of wonder and some fear, actually, that went along with it. You might recall that Michael Crichton's Andromeda strain had just come out, and there was some feeling of, could this happen to us now that we've gone to another planetary body, really, the moon? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I began to get a little bit older that I actually put myself in that position and say, I wonder if I could do such a thing.
You know, I never thought about that. I'd forgotten all about the fears of bringing back some sort of dreaded contagious disease from being on a foreign body.
Exactly.
But should we be concerned about that? I mean, as we explore other parents and planets and we are actually looking for signs of life, or I guess we would be overjoyed if we found life, at least scientists would be, and most of that life would be at the microbial level. Should we be concerned about bringing something back?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, the big concern is bringing microorganisms to a sterile environment. Maybe Mars does have microorganisms. It'd be great to go there and find that out. I think it could be one of the greatest discoveries in all of human history to find life on other planets. But the big concern is actually introducing life accidentally and then thinking we had discovered it. So making sure we have sterile spacecraft and making sure we keep people separate if they go to that planet, go to Mars, for instance, making sure they're separate from the environment, that's going to be the big challenge.
You are trained as a physician, and before you came to NASA, you were in medicine, emergency medicine, for years and years. You came to NASA as a flight surgeon, and I've heard that term many times. What exactly does that mean? What does being a flight surgeon entail?
That's a good question. Flight surgeon does not do surgery, and we don't do it in flight. But it came out of World War I, actually, when aviators were suffering illnesses and actually injury and death due to illness more than from any enemy gunfire. So they instituted doctors that were dedicated to a flight squadron, doctors who perhaps flew with the squadron, were familiar with the environment that pilots had to deal with, and basically was maximizing their performance. So out of that, the military has always had flight surgeons that have taken care of squadrons of pilots, and at the Johnson Space Center, they also take care of the astronauts. Hmm.
And you helped develop the biomedical training program for flight surgeons and astronaut crew medical officers. So what does that mean? What did you actually develop?
Well, actually, I was part of the team that helped develop a program whereby you take your off-the-shelf physician from the outside, which I was. I was an emergency room doctor, already board certified in emergency medicine, and then put them through exactly that program so they could understand what are the physical problems associated with space flight, what are the health issues, the health challenges that astronauts have to face when they fly in space. So that was the main thing. One of the things that was most fun was develop a program to turn astronauts into crew medical officers. That is, try to make a doctor in a week as fast as best as you can. So it was a program that we put them into emergency rooms. They worked alongside physicians to actually take care of patients. So they get used to that feeling of putting your hands on a human body, dealing with blood and other things that humans tend to put out, and dealing with the stress of that. So it was kind of a medical boot camp. That was a lot of fun.
I would think if you had to put those skills to work after a week of training in space, it would be horrifically frightening. but it also seems to me that in space, the challenges of having to deal with an injured person must be monumental, even for a trained physician.
Well, it's certainly something we think about a lot, absolutely, as a trained physician. The biggest problems being restraint, keeping things from floating around, making sure fluids, IV fluids, don't have bubbles in them. How do you separate the fluid from the bubbles? The human body in its normal state in space is different than the human body on the ground, so you have to be used to that.
Yeah.
So medical care in general would be very familiar to your primary care or emergency doctor in space, but all those other nuances make a big difference.
You are also a pilot. Did being a pilot also play a role in your coming to not only to the space program, but your transition from a ground-based medical expert working with both the U.S. and Russia in various parts of their space programs before actually going into space?
Yeah, I fell in love with space before I fell in love with aviation. It was a bit of a stepping stone, but you're exactly right. I did want to understand the environment as best I could. So even to the point of doing some skydiving. And we have ejection seats in our aircraft, and I wanted to know, hey, what's it like on the other side of the ejection to come down under a parachute? So I wanted to put myself through all of that. So I got several certifications in aviation as well.
Are you a risk taker? It sounds like you're a risk taker.
Well, as we like to say, yeah, I am. As we like to say, I take calculated risks. I'm not into bungee jumping or cliff diving or anything like that.
Why not? Why not?
Too many unknowns. I'd like to be able to test my body limits and understand those limits and know when I can stop instead of saying, I'm going to jump off a cliff and just see what happens. So we like to say they're calculated risks. A lot of astronauts are like that.
To become an astronaut, to be sent into space, men and women go through a lot of additional training, even if they're pilots. After all that training, there's still no guarantee that you'll ever get a ride into space. So when you're in the astronaut corps, for lack of a better term, do you jockey for position, or is it completely beyond the trained astronaut's control as to whether or not they will actually get a chance to go up?
Well, astronauts are competitive by nature, so that does not go away when you become an astronaut. What you do find out, though, is the person you think you're competing with might very well be your commander or your crewmate, and that becomes a realization very quickly. So the way I approached it is I wanted to be as good as my colleagues. Every one of them, all of my classmates were stellar people, very accomplished in their fields. I couldn't be better than them. So it was a matter of keeping up. And so we would egg each other on in that regard. A lot of humor involved, no backstabbing, anything like that, because that just doesn't go along with forming a team to fly in space.
What kind of a person, what kind of background must they have in order to even be considered a candidate for training to become an astronaut? What are the basics that you have to bring to the table?
Well, right now, NASA expects to hire people with a technical background, PhD level or equivalent work experience. And by technical, I include mathematics, astronomy, medicine. Now, there are plenty of pilots as well that don't necessarily have the degree qualifications, but they are test pilots, which in my mind by itself is a graduate degree. It's a very incredible incredibly difficult thing to get into and accomplish. So those have been the standard backgrounds. Astronauts tend to be workaholics. We tend to love what we do and have a passion for it. And that's what we tell anyone that's interested in being an astronaut. Do what you love, because you'll be good at it, and you'll need to work that hard.
Part of the training, I know, is water and wilderness survival training. Is that because of what might happen during reentry? You could end up in an ocean someplace or some remote part of the world?
Certainly that, particularly with the new spacecraft that NASA's building to start launching humans again, the Orion spacecraft. It could end up on its way back from deep space anywhere in the world. But it's also the very first step in being a jet pilot. And high-performance jets, the Air Force T-38, is our primary trainer to get people ready for space flight. So it's a necessary step. Mm-hmm. Along the way, though, it builds a lot of skills. It builds a lot of team building. It's good for everybody to understand what it's like to be a little bit uncomfortable and to think on your feet, because that's exactly what spaceflight is like.
So how do you train for that? Do they just throw you out in the middle of a desert someplace and say you're on your own for a week?
Just about. I've done several survival training scenarios. My favorite, partly because it was both fun and very painful at the time, was to spend 8 days on the Continental Divide in Wyoming in the dead of winter in February, 20 below, gale force winds, and they did give us training to show us how to build snow caves and igloos, and a little bit of training on walking around with cross-country skis. Me being a Georgia boy, I was more like a baby deer on ice than being able to be proficient on the skis, but we all pulled together, and we spent a lot of time in snow caves, but we had to move around quite a bit. It was a huge challenge. They're great memories. And these are the kinds of astronauts love to do anyway. So we'd probably be paying to do it if we didn't have a chance to do it.
Did they just throw you out there? Or is this some sort of a safety net that if you really got into trouble, if you really couldn't survive, that they would come get you?
Yeah, safety is primary on all this. I mean, taking an inherently risky endeavor, which is what spaceflight is, and keeping it as safe as possible. They prepare us. We might have 2 days of classes, familiarization with the hardware. And then when they throw you out there, usually there's someone watching from far away. We can't see them, but they can see us, or they periodically come check on us. So they're out there. But you're still very remote.
I want to get back to this Orion spacecraft. I'm a big fan of the space program and follow it as closely as I can from afar. But I did not know that we were building a new spacecraft, and I did not know it was called the Orion spacecraft. So what kind of a spacecraft is this going to be?
Well, it's going to look a lot like Apollo used to look, but it's bigger. So it's a throwback, if you will, to the Apollo shape. Turns out, spacecraft that come into the atmosphere at very high velocities, like we will from deep space, all kind of have to look the same, because that's just the physics of reentry. So the current plan, I believe, is to hold 4 individuals. The rocket's going to be enormous, the Space Launch System, because it's going to send this thing into deep space. This will be the rocket that we could use to send separate pieces of a spacecraft that could, say, go to an asteroid or to Mars.
I have more questions about Orion and whether or not it's a step backward, because it seems to me that it would be more comfortable to fly into deep space in a vehicle not unlike the shuttle. But we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about that in a second. Dr. Tom Marshburn, NASA astronaut and physician, joining us today from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI PBS Charlotte, presenting Season 4 of Downton Abbey, Sundays at 9, beginning this Sunday. Details at pbscharlotte.org. We are back live in the studio on Monday on Charlotte Talks with a look back at the economy of 2013. It was a roller coaster year by any account. Government shutdowns and uncertainty over the budget gradually gave way to a bipartisan budget deal at the very end of the year, which should avert some artificial crisis for the next few years. The stock market was jittery at times, but made significant gains in 2013. So, what kind of year was it? And what are we likely to experience in the year ahead? That's the topic when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And back to our conversation with astronaut Tom Marshburn in just a moment.
On On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act begins. The new mayor of New York City promises to tackle income inequality and the latest job numbers.
Domestic news in Hour 1, international news in Hour 2. That's the Friday News Roundup, today from 10 to noon, on the Diane Rehm Show on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Tom Marshburn's our guest, a NASA astronaut, born in Statesville, moved to Georgia, and is speaking to us today from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We were talking just before the break about the new Orion spacecraft, which looks like the Apollo spacecraft, if you remember the moon landing program, but it will hold four astronauts, and it's being designed to send astronauts into deep space. Why not a shuttle-like craft, which would, I think, give you more space, be more comfortable for what would have to be a pretty long mission?
Yeah, the interior of the shuttle is roomy. It's beautiful. I did a shuttle flight in 2009, lived there for 16 days. But it's big, and it's great for low Earth orbit. It's particularly important if you want to grab stuff like satellites out of low Earth orbit and bring them home.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are bringing a crew into deep space, it's going to have to be smaller. It's going to have to withstand enormous temperatures as it slams into the atmosphere while it's falling back to the Earth from its journey at about 25,000 miles per hour escape velocity. So that all dictates the shape and the size, and it looks like the Orion's going to be about the shape of an Apollo command module, but it's going to be bigger.
So why not do what, I hate to be science fiction in a conversation with a real astronaut here, but why not do what Star Wars and Star Trek did and have a larger vehicle in space that you ferry up to and then take that out into deep space and then come back and park it in orbit and pick up your capsule and go back to Earth?
Well, that's exactly what we'll end up doing, certainly. That's oftentimes people that work in the space program are inspired by what happens in science fiction. There's all kinds of analogies made with Star Trek and the tricorder and such. So, yeah, the Orion, even though it can take a crew into deep space for, say, a month-long journey, if we go further, if we go longer periods of time, we're going to need more modules, and we would do exactly that. Assemble those on orbit, just like we did the space station. Mm-hmm. The space station is a precursor to the next interplanetary vehicle, and then move on from there and get out of low Earth orbit and push this large spacecraft further.
How many times have you been into space?
I've been into space twice, 2009 on the shuttle, and then I launched on the Russian Soyuz rocket out of Kazakhstan December of last year and just came back in May of this year.
Talk about our two nations' different approaches to launch and recovery. The Soyuz capsule is much different from the shuttle. It's more like our old space capsules.
That's exactly right. It is. And in some ways, it looks the same. Again, the physics dictates the shape, and the Soyuz is the perfect shape for coming home in a safe and stable way. We reach the temperatures of 3,000 degrees on the outside as we're really a meteor as we come back through the atmosphere. We think of the Soyuz as a little sports car and the shuttle as a large, very modern, very nice truck, if you will. But we enjoy flying the Soyuz. It has a high level of redundancy, even though there's a lot of digital screens and controls, just like in the shuttle. You can also just push buttons to fire off explosives that do the things the spacecraft has to do to get you home safely. The shuttle is much bigger and roomier. The landing in the shuttle is very smooth compared to the Soyuz. The Soyuz landing is just hilariously violent. It's quite a ride.
How does it? It comes down on land, doesn't it?
That's right. You land in the deserts of Kazakhstan. It feels like a car crash. If you've ever been rear-ended by somebody going about 20 miles an hour, that's what it feels like.
Why don't you get hurt in the process of doing that?
Well, they've got a lot of safeguards in place. Of course, you're under a parachute that slows you down from your Mach 20 entry when you hit the atmosphere. There are retro rockets that fire a split second before you hit. That takes away some of the velocity. But then when you actually hit, your seat actually has hydraulics in it that give, so that you have some throw. That takes some of the energy away. But the most important thing is we have conformal couches, couches that were poured and molded exactly to our individual backs. So there's no shaking of the body around. Now, having said that, they train us as well. They say, don't be talking during landing or you might bite your tongue off and keep your elbows inside. So we have to be careful about that.
Americans, when we flew capsules into space, we always landed in the water, in the ocean. Why do they choose to land on solid ground?
That's a good question. They have this immense expanse of land. It used to be a part of the Soviet Union. Now it's Kazakhstan. It's one of the largest geographically countries in the world. So it looks like an ocean when you're looking at it. Then you got China that's in the way. And then you have international waters after that. So they elected to take this empty space and do a land landing, which actually made things a little simpler. It did concern in the U.S.-based program, it did concern us that we'd have these heroes come back from the moon and then have the Apollo's craft crack when it hit the ocean and then sink to the bottom of the ocean. So they didn't have to worry about any of that happening.
Mm. So which is the more dangerous, the more uncomfortable, the more frightening, the more concerning? I'm not sure the questions or the adjectives to use here. Is it the launch where you're sitting on top of a bomb, essentially, or is it the reentry and landing?
Our history has shown that launch and landing, both, are perhaps equally dangerous. We've lost more people in entry, and I'm including Russians as well as Americans, particularly in the early development of the Soyuz. The shuttle, of course, we've lost a crew on launch, Challenger, and landing, Columbia. So it was deemed that the shuttle was perhaps too dangerous. It's when you sit inside the shuttle, you're in the middle of all of your fuel. You're in a cluster of bombs, really. Whereas with the Soyuz or the new Orion, the old Gemini, and Apollo spacecraft, you're sitting on the top. So you could have an escape tower that would blast you away in case there was an explosion on the pad. When you use the word frightening, astronauts have a weird, perhaps, view of that. Fun, exciting, and frightening kind of all come in one package oftentimes. But as long as we understand the risk and understand what we're getting into and train for it, it's all actually a lot of fun. I would highly recommend successful launches and landings to anyone.
You do a lot of training as an astronaut in I guess what they call the vomit comet, the airplane that gives you a sensation of weightlessness for a few seconds here and there. Is that substantially different from what it feels like to be in a space capsule and break, as President Reagan said, the surly bonds of Earth? Is it the same sensation or is it a different sensation?
It is exactly the same sensation. The problem is it only lasts 25 seconds. And the 2G pullout at the bottom of the parabola in the vomit comet is nothing like spaceflight, and that's what gets people sick. I'll never forget my first experience of quote-unquote zero gravity in the vomit comet. It was the most delightful, life-changing experience for me, and it was exactly the way I felt when we reached orbit. Went on my first flight on the space shuttle.
Except you're strapped in, are you not? When you first get up into space in the capsule or in the space shuttle, you're strapped in, so you're not going to float away. So what is that sensation as you're strapped in? Do you just feel light?
Well, if you've ever ridden over the top of a roller coaster, usually the second hill, you've got some momentum, or in the car, come over a big hill, you feel your insides rise up on the inside of you. And that's a kind of a tingling, kind of exciting feeling. You could feel blood rise up into your head. And what's surprising about that with spaceflight is that it doesn't go away. It stays that way for the entire time that you are in outer space.
So when you are unstrapped and you're in the space station and you're allowed, well, you are, you're not allowed, you have to float around to get from one place to another because there's minimal gravity. How is it like swimming? Is it what is? I'm not sure how to ask the question because I've never had the experience. But what's it like?
It's delightful, slightly painful. On the ground, you're so used to extending your legs to stand up, which all that does is propel you headward, and you smack your head a lot when you get into space. You feel like a baby deer on ice. You haven't worked out yet how to push with your hands and your feet to get in the direction that you want to go. You don't know how to stabilize yourself. Every time you do anything, put on your pants or brush your teeth, you start to float away and tumble. So you have to learn lots of little tricks, using your toes to hold yourself down, for instance. The entire time, though, I found it absolutely delightful experience. And that's one thing that I miss the most, is being able to fly like Superman and or to watch objects float in space.
You've also logged a considerable amount of time on spacewalks, and I know that you're tethered when you leave the interior of the space station or the spacecraft on these EVAs, but it must seem really psychologically strange to simply float free in an environment so foreign to anything that would be earthbound. The first time I went diving, I remember having to tell myself over and over and over that I can breathe. You can breathe. Go ahead and breathe, because you can't breathe underwater. So it was a real adjustment. What mental gymnastics do you have to do to be comfortable on a spacewalk?
There's a lot, actually. Impossible to train it on the ground, even though that training is some of the best. You go out of the hatch, particularly on your first spacewalk, and the open space, particularly in relation to the spaceship that you just came out of, is breathtaking. Not only the Earth, which you can see completely laid out below you, but the blackness of space, which has a three-dimensional, oily, kind of liquid quality to it. It's more than just the color black. You almost feel drawn as if you could be sucked away from the space station. So oftentimes, novice spacewalkers have a death grip on their handrails, and you have to relax. So you just kind of let your hands go, realize you're not going to go anywhere. But we do like to keep pretty close to that space station. We don't want to be floating away from it.
Are you not going anywhere? Because you're going at the same speed around the Earth that the space station is? Or if you just let go and didn't take any steps to maneuver, would you eventually separate?
Oh, you'd separate all right. Now, we do have the safety tether that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. We train, though, in case that tether were to break or separate for some reason. We have little jetpacks. And every time we do a spacewalk, we wear this little jetpack, and we train to come flying off the space station, be able to turn around and come back safely.
How do you train for that?
Because on which way?
How do you train for that? Because on Earth, it wouldn't work the same way.
Virtual reality. Yeah, virtual reality. That's the only way to do it. So we wear goggles, we have gloves, and so they can detect our movements.
So the movie Gravity, have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. Saw the movie, yep.
How accurate is their depiction of being on a spacewalk?
Certain aspects I thought were really well done. The feeling of the combination of claustrophobia inside the helmet and agoraphobia, seeing just these incredible wide open spaces, really infinity is what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. That was well displayed. I thought the movements of the astronauts when they were having to move themselves about in their spacesuits, on their spacewalks, that was very realistic. I could almost feel myself making some of those movements and struggling along with them. Mm-hmm. The physics of the whole problem and getting between the spaceships, that just didn't work out, but shoot, you know, you could forget that and enjoy the
show. Well, you
know,
one of the criticisms of the film is that Sandra Bullock is, her character is a medical expert, so why would she be fixing something outside the space station? Well, you are a medical expert, and you were on spacewalks. Why were you outside fixing stuff?
Hey, they've had medical doctors working on the Hubble space craft before, and the reason for that is when you become an astronaut, you become an astronaut first, and your former specialty is second. They select astronauts to be flexible, to be able to learn how to do whatever they task us to do. So it's actually very likely that a doctor could be doing that. It's happened.
Any spacecraft, but particularly the space station, the International Space Station, is, I'm told, the most complex piece of equipment ever designed and built by human beings. Is that correct?
I would have to agree with that, particularly when you consider it was built in different places of the Earth, different countries, and the first time those pieces ever came together was in orbit.
Wow.
And it has to work exactly right the first time.
So given the complexity of all of that, you have everybody up there has a different background. None of you worked on the design or the construction of these pieces of equipment, and yet you are called upon to fix things when they break because you're the only people there. You can't call the plumber when a pump leaks, and you had to make a spacewalk in 2012 to replace a leaking ammonia pump. Are the procedures necessary to do something like that fairly cut and dry? I mean, how do you? Because of all the things that could go wrong, you can't possibly train for every single thing.
Oh, you're absolutely right. That's, I believe, some of the advances of spaceflight, trying to figure out how to make generic procedures. but train people to deal with the inevitable hardware problems that arise, and to be able to deal with that on your own independently. I just finished up a training program we're evaluating of having astronauts. I did this for 3 weeks. Astronauts hang out with jet mechanics and work side by side with them, because they have to do the same thing. That's their job. They've been doing it their whole lives, seeing how they approach problems, seeing how they handle tools, what are the tricks of the trade, and really learning to think how they think. So that's the goal before someone flies in space. And yeah, well, you're on your own up there. You have help from the ground, but you got to figure it out, because you're the only one looking at that thing that's broken.
One of the purposes of being in space, obviously, is to conduct scientific experiments. What sort of experiments are being conducted up there? What kind of experiments did you participate in?
Yeah, that's the major purpose of my stay on the space station. There were six of us up there. We had over 130 experiments going on actively. There's thousands actually that could be going on. Everything from material science, fluid physics, combustion physics, I was a guinea pig in medical experiments. You know, spaceflight is an accelerated aging process. Our bones get weak, our muscles get atrophied. The radiation affects our cardiovascular system. So we were studying all of that on ourselves, see how we could counteract that, and has with obvious implications for the ground. But I could keep going on and on. A lot of Earth observations going on, astronomy, etc.
Why does radiation penetrate the capsule or the space station?
It's a high radiation environment out there. You have solar particles. You have galactic cosmic rays, which are high radiation particles coming from supernovas. We are actually protected by that, by our atmosphere and by the magnetic field of the Earth. You're outside that or higher up in all that when you're in space, so you get affected by all that. The spaceship is not enough. The aluminum shielding just simply doesn't protect you sufficiently. So we are radiation workers. We get more radiation in 6 months than a career limit for a terrestrial radiation worker.
A lot of people question the need for and the efficacy of spending so much money on space. Given that, what are some of the tangible results from either the experiments conducted in space or the technology developed to conduct those experiences, or even just to travel in space itself? What are some of the tangible things that have come out of it?
Well, yeah, I would start by saying, when you say so much, it's 0.5% of the federal budget goes to everything that NASA does, include the Mars rovers, the Hubble Space Telescope, et cetera. So that funding goes partly towards the research on the station, and what has come from that have been new materials that have, well, it looks like I'm
you get to the
being able to go in well past through the 20 seconds, new materials, new medical procedures, particularly in remote locations that we could be using on Earth, and osteoporosis treatments and cures. There's many, many more.
Yeah, we'll come back to that, because I think there's some things, particularly in the medical field, that have revolutionized treatments on Earth because of space. And we'll come right back and talk about that with Dr. Tom Marshburn, NASA astronaut, here on WFAE Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bylo Supermarkets, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bylo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bylo Bonus Card, store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks. Program details at buy-lo.com. It's Friday. That means the news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Domestic news in Hour 1. Health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act begins. The new mayor of New York City promises to tackle income inequality. State-regulated marijuana sales begin in Colorado. In Hour 2, international news, Russian arrests after the suicide bombings there, fighting in South Sudan, and Secretary of State Kerry returns to Israel for Middle East peace talks. All that begins at 10 o'clock on the Friday news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Back to our conversation in just a moment on WFAE.
Is a GED really the same as a high school diploma? A lot of economists say no.
The goal of education, part of it is that you are, you know, certifying a full set of skills. And the GED is just an interesting case because it's not the full set.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Changes ahead for the GED. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us for Marketplace this evening from 6:30 to 7 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. Tom Marshburn, a NASA astronaut and physician who recently returned from an extended stay on the space station, which we'll talk about in a second. Just prior to the break, and there wasn't enough time to really get into the answer, I asked Dr. Marshburn, what are some of the tangible benefits that have come out of the space program, and particularly in the medical field, there are a number of things that have revolutionized treatment on Earth for ordinary people because of what of experiments conducted in space, right?
Oh, yeah. It's so much a part of our culture now that it's a part of our lives. It's easy to forget about them. You know, the first defibrillators were developed with the help of NASA physicians back in the 60s, in the late 50s. The CAT scan that we use today all the time, a lot of the imaging analysis and imaging technology was developed during the space program for with the lunar radar as we're searching for places for astronauts to land. I've personalized one of the experiments I was involved in. I just found it very fascinating. The purpose of the experiment was try to figure out how we could use capillary fluid flow to develop fuel tanks in spaceships that don't need pumps, just let the fluid flow on it by itself. Well, it turns out that's the way blood behaves when it's in tiny, tiny volumes. And a lot of advancements have been made in the, you may have heard of a laboratory on a chip where you take a little spot of blood and then you can do an entire laboratory's worth of experiments using just a very small handheld device. Hmm. And a lot of breakthroughs in that have been made with that one experiment that I was involved with. Looking at the way astronauts are affected, humans are affected in the high radiation, zero gravity environment, but learning a lot about muscle atrophy, osteoporosis, how it happens, why it happens, and ways to counteract it, how to repair the body after radiation hits, which is somewhat related to aging, particularly with the heart, how to counteract cardiac muscle atrophy. And again, I could keep going. Just tell me if you want me to stop.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, another experiment, I start to get excited about it, ultrasound. We're using ultrasound in space. It's the only way that we can do medical imaging in space. We don't have X-ray machines up there. Well, it turns out there's a lot the ultrasound can do. Now, we hadn't thought about it on the ground because we do have X-ray machines on the ground in most places, populated areas. In underdeveloped or less developed countries and remote locations, even in the U.S., turns out ultrasound can be delivered to those places without an expert using telemedicine techniques developed by NASA to bring very high quality, big city medical care to remote locations. And that's there's a group that presents to the UN on an annual basis advancements in that area, which I was involved in.
You've already talked a little bit about the International Space Station, which is remarkable not only because it is pieces of it have been built by various different countries, and the only time it is ever determined that it actually can come together is when it's in space, and then it's too late. There are no tolerances. I mean, you have to be in tolerance. But the other thing about the International Space Station, and you spent some time there, a considerable amount of time there, is that there were 13 astronauts from all five international partners on board when you were there. The Russian Space Agency, NASA, the Canadian Space Agency, the European Space Agency, and the Japanese Space Agency. How do all of these people communicate? How do all of these people from different cultural backgrounds spend time together in such tight quarters?
Well, it turns out we're all a lot more alike than we are different. Number one, survival. We all rely completely on each other to survive in that environment. The other is the shared experience of the incredible experience living in space, seeing the Earth from space. That all of those go completely across any cultural, ethnic, or language barriers. Now, for practical purposes, English is the official language on the space station. We learned Russian not only to fly in the Soyuz, but also to assist us in case of an emergency. Someone reverts back to their native language. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can speak all of the languages up there, but pretty close, actually.
Wow.
So it's essential to survival there, but like I say, human beings are a lot alike.
13 people is a lot of people. How big is the space station?
Space station's about the size of a 5-bedroom house. But imagine that you can utilize the ceiling. You can float up and get into your quarter of the ceiling if you want to. So there's more space than you would imagine. We've never lost anyone up there. But you could probably do a game of hide and seek if you wanted to.
Where does the oxygen come from? I know that obviously it's taken up there in some form at some time, but you've got to run out. I mean, how do you generate breathable air?
The Russians bring up tanks of air, which they can feed into the space station that delivers both nitrogen and oxygen. We have also tanks of pressurized oxygen up there on the space station. Another thing we do is to extract our oxygen from our carbon dioxide. It's an enclosed system inside the space station. Everything a human puts out is recycled, just about.
Yes, let's talk about
that. Is recycled and given back to us.
Let's talk about that. Everything.
It's a beautiful system. Yeah. I'm very familiar with it because we have to maintain those systems.
Mm-hmm.
But everything except the solid output is reused.
Does that take some mental gymnastics to get around? I mean, and we have to realize that here on Earth, everything is recycled as well. We just don't think about it in those terms.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, the galley water, which was yesterday's coffee, perhaps, that I'm drinking again today, is pure, clean, tastes like regular water. No problem at all.
I've talked to other astronauts about this, and I don't know whether it was just one astronaut who told me this or more than one, but they say that space, although it's a vacuum, has an odor to it, which you can smell when you come back in from an extra vehicular spacewalk. You close the hatch, repressurize, and space smells like something burnt. Would you say that's true?
Yes, it's a real privilege to be on the inside after a spacewalk and to grab those two men or two women that have just been out on a spacewalk, grab their suits and feel how cold the suit is. The metal is almost so cold you can't touch it, because the heat has just gone away in the vacuum. But you smell, I think it's more like a burnt bacon smell. It's slightly sweet, perhaps. Not quite sure where it comes from, but that is the odor.
Maybe it's all those burning stars?
Perhaps. It might be off-gassing of metal once they come back in the space station. But maybe ozone of the air, as the air is exposed to that first comes in is exposed to vacuum in the airlock.
You've also served as an aquanaut during the Nemo 14 mission on the Aquarius Underwater Laboratory. You spent 14 days underwater. How unusual is it for an astronaut to become an aquanaut?
Fairly rare, because it's a new program and not all of us get to do that. But boy, it is the best analog for a spaceflight. Working in an unusual, beautiful environment that's tightly enclosed, you're shoulder to shoulder with your colleagues for 2 solid weeks. But wonderful experience living at 70 feet of depth off the coast of Key Largo for 2 weeks, saturation diving. You're far away from the surface because it takes at least 24 hours to get back up, so you don't get the bends.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel very remote from there, but an enormous amount of fun down there.
So which is the more challenging environment to live and work in, underwater or up in space?
Up in space, because it's such a new environment, you have to adapt to it. Floating around actually makes the hard things easy. That is, moving something that weighs 200 pounds is no problem in space, but finding a place to put your pencil is very difficult in space. You can lose things very easily. You can lose yourself. You can float away very easily. And it's a very intense work environment. We are going a fairly punishing schedule. We're going hard every day. And there's lots and lots of people watching. And that makes a big difference on the space station.
And you say every day. Well, the space station is going, 64,000 miles an hour? Is that right?
No, 17,500 miles per hour to stay in orbit.
All right. So that means you're going around the Earth how many times in the 24-hour period?
16 times a day.
16 times a day.
So we see 16 sunrises and sunsets a day. Yep.
So to our one day, you have 16. So how do you figure, what do you call a space day? What is a space day? What is time about in space?
It's actually easy. You make it up because the outside environment has nothing to do with a, you know, a cycle of the Earth's rotation or something. So you make it up. We've decided to go with Greenwich Mean Time. It's halfway between Moscow and Houston. And the ground tells us when to wake up and tells us when to go to bed. And that's the schedule we live by.
So if the ground was not there to tell you to wake up and to go to bed, what would happen to your body clock? What kind of a cycle do you think you would find yourself on?
You know, they do. They've done studies to show that most people have a slightly longer than 24-hour schedule. So we'd probably stay awake a little bit longer than we do on the Earth. The fascinating thing about being in the space station is when we do sleep shift, it's very hard to figure out what time of day it is. Your body just really doesn't know what to make of it. But the one thing I found out that I could always count on that only happens during the day is Russian communication. You start to hear a lot of Russian voices between the Russian crew and their mission control center only during the daytime, quote-unquote, daytime work hours.
When you were in space for 6 months, is that right?
Yeah, 5 months, yep.
5 months. That is an enormously long time. And you came back after 5 months in May of this year, and you told the Charlotte Observer in July that you were still recovering. In what way?
Well, at that time, I hadn't gotten all my muscle mass back yet. I hadn't been able to go to the gym and push myself as much as I wanted to as I could pre-flight. And probably right now, even though I feel completely adapted right now, I'm probably on the inside still recovering. My eyesight had changed a little bit, and my bones are probably still a little bit weaker. We work out hard when we get back to get those bones back strong again.
Can you exercise in space? I mean, is there resistance in space that you can do to keep your muscle mass from decreasing as much as it would if you didn't do anything?
Yeah, there is, and it's a wonderful machine. They use vacuum pistons to create the resistance, and I can't actually do it, but you could squat or deadlift the equivalent of 600 pounds, and you can gauge that down to your strength level and do all kinds of exercises up there. We have a treadmill, we've got a cyclergometer, and we spend 2.5 hours a day working out.
And your eyesight, you said, has changed while you were in space. What happens to your eyes and why?
Well, a big discovery a few years ago. It turns out we're not quite sure why it happens, but the shape of the eye changes in space. Probably there's increased pressure inside the brain that's affecting eyesight, affecting the structure of the optic nerve. You know, this is why we continue to fly in space. We haven't solved all the problems yet. And for men, older men over the age of 40, flying long-duration space flight, as we probably do going to Mars or to an asteroid, we're going to have to deal with this problem, figure out what's causing it. And
do you become more nearsighted, more farsighted? What happens to your eyesight?
You become more farsighted. You can see better far away, and it's harder to see up close. And I might add, it's fascinating. They've done so many studies on us, new studies on us, to figure it out. A lot of doctors are finding out, hey, we can use some of these techniques to look at our patients that have problems we couldn't explain before, and they're starting to explain problems with increased pressure on the brain and eyesight issues that hadn't been able to explain before. It's a fascinating thing.
Weightlessness, is that the only thing that impacts the body? You talked about radiation as well, but I mean, are we discovering, what are we discovering about the long-term impact of being in space?
Well, first of all, that the body is incredibly adaptable. You know, the brain actually rewires itself so that you can operate and forget about up and down, but still figure out where your body is in space. Your gastrointestinal system readapts. Your blood supply, it actually gets thinner, and you get rid of some fluid, but that's a completely adaptive state. But yeah, the bones get weaker, the muscles get weaker, you have to work on that, the eyesight changes, and we still don't understand the radiation effects either. But you're also, psychologically, there's a lot of advance to be made yet in making sure people are productive and happy.
Only have a couple minutes left. There's no gravity. Is there no gravity at all on the space station, or is it just a tiny amount of gravity still coming from the Earth? And if the space station were to be pushed out further into space, would there be even less gravity in the space station?
If you push the space station out further, there would be less. But actually, there's quite a bit of gravity in space. It does get less as you get further away, but that's why we go so fast sideways, 17,500 miles an hour, because we're at a free fall. Just like the Vomit Comet, we are in a free fall around the Earth, but because we're going so fast sideways, we don't hit the Earth. We continue to circle around it in an orbit, and that's why we don't experience the effects of gravity.
And what maintains that orbit? Do you have to occasionally fire off some sort of booster to keep it going that fast?
Just adjustment, but really there's nothing slowing it down. There's only very few molecules of air slowing it down, so that initial kick into orbit from your rocket that launches you there, that's what keeps you there the whole time.
You have said that the view of the Earth from space is life-changing, and other astronauts have said the same thing. Now, we've all seen these photographs of the Earth from space and from the moon and from the space station and from the shuttle. Do the photos compare to the real thing?
Mike, no, they don't. And the glow of the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere, to me, is the most dramatic thing. The depth of the blackness of outer space, it all enhances the beauty of our planet. It's just like a jewel. I fell in love with our planet again while I was there. But also how small it is in comparison to the rest of the universe. You get just an inkling of the infinity of the space beyond it. It really digs deep in your soul. It takes your breath away.
Mm. We have a school teacher in Iredell County who wants you to come back, and she teaches science in Statesville and wants you to come back and impress upon her students the importance of science. Hopefully this conversation has. And if you were a young person and you wanted to go into space, what would you do to prepare in 10 seconds or less?
Study hard, do what you love, and take care of yourself.
Tom Marshburn, NASA astronaut, joining us today from the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.